This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, a civil liberties attorney reacts to the Palmyra Police Department's decision to help ICE agents question and detain immigrants.
First, it's the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Member Drive. Keely Boltina is in the studio with us. Your gift makes a huge difference because listeners are the largest source of funding for WPR programs. And today only, your donation will be doubled with our $50,000 for dollar match. Step up and be counted as a supporter. Get your gift matched with a gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
That $50,000 is an incredible amount. Thank you so much to the donors and the supporters who are encouraging you to give right now. This is our first member drive since federal funding was eliminated for public media. WPR will continue to be your source for information and connection, but your support is more important now than ever before. So let's keep WPR strong together with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Yeah, a large slice of funding for WPR, the biggest and most reliable slice, is listener support. So while all of our funding sources are important, your contribution makes a huge difference. WPR is the amazing and varied service that it is thanks to your support. Keep independent, high-quality programs on the air when you give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thank you so much for being a WPR listener. We really appreciate you being here. And thank you to everyone who's already a member. It is listener support, your support, that makes WPR really an unparalleled resource in Wisconsin and beyond.
Because WPR is your radio home. Support it now. Make WPR's trustworthy journalism, thought-provoking conversations, and so much more possible with your first ever gift of $10 or $20 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Hi, I'm John White. Let's talk about public radio. I've been listening to public radio for about 15 years. Civil discourse makes public broadcasting all the more valuable because it sifts out the noise, the anger, and agenda setting of commercial media. That's why public radio is my source for the gold standard in fair and honest discussion.
Support that service when you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. It's the Fall Member Drive on Wisconsin Today. Keely Boltina in the studio with us. Listener support is the biggest source of funding for WPR, and that is why your gift of $5 or $10 a month or $50 or $100 a month, whatever amount you choose, has a really big impact.
Supporting Wisconsin Public Radio right now is a great thing to do, and I promise it takes just a few minutes of your time. All we need is your name, your contact information, how much you want to give, and how you want to pay.
Your gift then supports the stories and programs that keep you connected to the world. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
A successful member drive works when everyone joins in. And remember, to encourage you to join right now, we have a $50,000 dollar-for-dollar match in effect right now. That means when you give $100, it becomes $200 for WPR. Now is the time. Go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552, and your support of WPR goes twice as far.
Ask for your WPR Canvas backpack this drive. This quality bag will show off your commitment to WPR. It'll be handy for all your outings around town or on day trips. Ask for that backpack while supplies last at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And when you're there, you know, donating, making sure you get that thank you note that is the Canvas backpack, consider becoming a sustainer. If you are not a sustainer right now, it is so easy to set up. You make ongoing monthly donations from a bank account or a credit card. You do that at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and you provide reliable support for the programs you love.
Larry in Wakefield, Michigan says, I enjoy the local Wisconsin programming. Larry, thank you so much. As Wisconsin Today a big source of that local Wisconsin programming. How about you make your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and thank you.
It's Wisconsin Today. Now, in southeastern Wisconsin, a village's police department has agreed to assist Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, agents.
Under a pending contract, the Palmyra Public Safety Department would be able to work with ICE, questioning people about their immigration status and making federal immigration arrests.
Palmyra's police department is on an ICE list that includes hundreds of participating local agencies across the country. It would be the first police department in Wisconsin to get what's known as Task Force Model Authority.
Around the U.S., local law enforcement is training with ICE agents and becoming part of the federal government's immigration crackdown. According to ICE, as of yesterday, the agency has signed over 500 of these task force model agreements with local agencies in 35 states.
The ACLU of Wisconsin is monitoring these agreements. Tim Muth is a senior staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, and I'm happy to be here again.
What does a task force model agreement mean for Palmyra's law enforcement department?
Yeah, it's essentially a kind of partnership agreement with ICE that deputizes police officers in the Palmyra Police Department who get trained by ICE to essentially be ICE agents out in the community. So they're able to stop people on the street, interrogate them about their immigration status, and potentially start the process of having somebody being deported.
What type of training do they receive from ICE to make these actions?
That is not entirely clear. ICE has not been transparent in making available its training materials. We believe that there is some training about the basics of immigration law, but this is ICE is ramping up very rapidly, and whether or not it is providing sufficient training about people's constitutional rights, et cetera, we have grave concerns.
I've been scrolling through the Excel document of participating agencies these last couple days. ICE, it looks like, is inking these task force model contracts very quickly, but some are pending. Can you talk about what is pending here and how will these task force model agreements impact immigration enforcement?
Well, one thing I want to point out is that yesterday, Palmyra's agreement was switched from the pending list to the participating agency list.
Yes, yes.
Pending, as I understand it, means the agreement has not yet been signed by everybody who needed to sign it. So maybe the head of ICE was not available to put his signature on the document. But when it is pending, it means that a local agency has applied and indicated its interest and willingness to be a partner with ICE.
Without this task force model agreement, what are local police departments legally able to do in the area of immigration enforcement?
Very little, if anything. Local police departments are tasked with enforcing our state and local laws, and immigration is purely a federal matter to be investigated by the federal government. And if you think about it, different state and local crimes, like driving without a license, it doesn't matter why you were driving without a license. It doesn't matter your immigration status. It just matters that you didn't have a license. And that's true for basically every state and local kind of crime somebody might be arrested for. There is no reason for somebody's immigration status to be inquired into by a local police department.
Tim, what's in this for Palmyra? Why would a police department like Palmyra's want to participate?
So we've submitted an open records request asking for their projections of income and expense to try and figure out if there's a financial incentive. We know that ICE has been recruiting very aggressively to try and get local police departments, county sheriffs to sign up for these agreements. So we don't know if there were any financial inducements. We don't know if this is just a police department that wants to align itself with a particular political philosophy.
And there are other models of coordination with ICE. There's, of course, what we've been talking about, the task force model, but there's also the jail enforcement model and the warrant service officer program. How are those different?
Yes, both of those, and those are the only two kinds that have been in force in Wisconsin, and those are all with county sheriffs. And the jail enforcement model is what it sounds like. It is when somebody has already been arrested on a state or local charge and they are in custody in a jail. It is an agreement with ICE that the jail can investigate somebody's immigration status, who's already in custody for some state or local offense. The warrant service officer agreement is really sort of a paper-pushing agreement. As its name, warrant service officer, it just means that the local sheriff's department can serve an ICE warrant on somebody who is in custody in the jail.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for your time and these explanations. We appreciate it.
Thanks for your interest and coverage of this topic.
Tim Muth is a senior staff attorney at the ACLU of Wisconsin. We talked about the first police department in Wisconsin to enter a task force cooperation agreement with ICE. Palmyra's interim police chief and director of public safety, Paul Blount, provided a comment. He said, quote, "If approved, this program would allow our trained officers to work in closer partnership with federal authorities, gaining access to databases and resources that enhance investigations and help us combat serious crimes such as narcotics trafficking and human trafficking." He went on to say this is a tool, not a blanket immigration enforcement program, and our focus is on criminals who threaten public safety, not law-abiding residents.
Coming up, the city of Superior built the infrastructure for high-speed internet. Find out what that means for local residents.
It's a long-term investment for the city. It's a long-term investment for our citizens across the board.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Just ahead, we'll learn how the city of Superior created its own broadband network and what other communities around the state are doing to try to fill service gaps.
But first, Keely Boltina is with me for this fall membership drive here at WPR. And we're here to say that your support is an essential piece of the funding for all the programs that you appreciate in WPR. And in fact, listener support is the largest source of funding for WPR programs. So this fall drive is your time to take action. You make the programs possible when you give at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
As a WPR listener, you probably know that Congress rescinded funding for public media this summer. WPR has been around for more than 100 years. It existed before federal funding for public media. We'll meet this challenge to keep serving you and your community. That future, though, counts on you right now. Let's keep WPR strong together. You can make your gift at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
We've been hearing an update from southeastern Wisconsin on the Palmyra Police Department working in cooperation with ICE. You know, looking at latest developments here in the state, the news that is breaking, we bring it to you because WPR covers the whole state, and it is listener-powered. It's listener-supported, and that means that when you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, you make this hour on Wisconsin Today and so many more hours possible. So choose an amount that works for you. Take a few minutes and make your gift.
Whether you've given before or maybe this is your first time ever making a donation, sign up for ongoing monthly gifts.
So you'll choose the amount that works for you at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. It only takes a few minutes, and once it's set up, your support for the programs you value is always current.
Many of us are committed to making our communities better. Maybe you help out at a school, or you make a meal for friends, or you run an errand when you know somebody's really busy, or there's somebody who has a sick kid. I mean, there are so many ways that you contribute to the greater good. And your financial support of Wisconsin Public Radio makes this community a better place, too.
Your investment, together with donations from other people, it makes the independent journalism and important conversations on WPR News available to everyone. We're proud to be an important part of the community, and in large part, that's thanks to you. Join in with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Hi, Larry Mueller here, and as I talk to you, I am wearing my WPR cap, my WPR t-shirt, and my WPR socks. It's nice to have quality WPR merch to show off as you're out and about. In this drive, we're offering the WPR Canvas Backpack. USA made, attractive design, big enough to hold groceries, picnic lunch, anything else. Give $22 a month or more and ask for your new WPR Canvas backpack. Here's a colleague to tell you how.
Go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 to make your donation. I just know Larry is decked out in his WPR gear.
That is accurate.
Very accurate. I'm Kate Archer-Kent here with Keely Voltina, and it's your support during this fall member drive that makes the news and these conversations you enjoy on WPR possible. So your gift of $10 or $20 a month, whatever amount you set it at, that is the right amount.
It's the little things that we spend money on that really add up. Maybe you buy a morning coffee or a little snack to get you through the afternoon. You might spend $20 a month on small expenses. It might even be more, but you know that, you know, they're an important part of your day.
And so is listening to WPR and checking in. Like the money you spend on a well-deserved treat, make your gift of $20 a month now for all the programs that enrich your daily life that are part of your routine. Go to WPR.org to make your donation or call 888-202-2552.
You are part of Wisconsin Public Radio's community of listeners. And it doesn't matter if you've been listening for years or just a few months. Maybe today is the first day you've discovered WPR. Either way, you can become part of our community of members, people who support the news and information and conversation that they value.
If you've never given before, start with a gift of $120. Or better yet, make that an ongoing gift of $10 a month. And your contribution of any amount makes you a member. And because the largest piece of our funding comes from members, you'll really make a difference. It all starts with your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Georgette in Luxembourg says, I learn something new all the time when I listen to WPR. I do not think you are alone, Georgette. In fact, I am absolutely in that camp. Thank you so much for sharing why you listen to WPR and how it makes a difference in your life.
Join Georgette right now with your gift at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. And thank you for your support.
This is Wisconsin Today. About 10% of people in Wisconsin don't have home internet access at all. Many communities around the state struggle with low speeds and a lack of reliable connection.
In just a bit, we'll hear from a community broadband expert about efforts to bring better internet to Wisconsin residents and why it's so important.
First, the city of Superior launched a new city-owned fiber optic network last month. The city supplies the infrastructure for Connect Superior. Then businesses can use that network to provide high-speed internet. Stephanie Becken is broadband manager for the city of Superior. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
This project in Superior has been a while in the making. What started this initial idea of having city-owned broadband to Superior?
I think the big thing, it wasn't the first idea, right? So when we go back a few years, the big catalyst for this was noticing that there's better options out there. And so originally Superior was reaching out to the incumbents, was reaching out to who already had systems here asking for better. And when the response wasn't what the city leadership at the time wanted to hear, right? There was not interest in making new investment. There was not interest in updating systems. Then those city leaders decided to keep digging, right? To find what the other options were. And after years of research, lots of consulting, lots of talking to other communities, the open access broadband system was what the city decided to go with. And so years and years in the making, lots of curiosity, lots of digging into what it means to take the very best care of our citizens when they need to navigate this digital world that we live in.
This open access system, spell it out for me. What are the nuts and bolts here?
Sure. So lots of different communities do this differently. This is very much the norm when you're in Europe, like if you're in Sweden, places like that. But what it means here is that the city owns the infrastructure. So the city of Superior owns all of the cable in the ground. They own all of the fiber. They own the systems that run everything. However, we do not provide the actual internet service. So we allow outside providers, internet service providers, to be the ones that provide the internet. So they're the ones that help the customers with their different packages that they might like. They're the ones that handle all of the actual billing to the customers at the very end. So there is just that layer of separation where, yes, we take care of the infrastructure. We make sure that person can get the access that they want, but then we leave it to the internet service provider to provide that service.
And that seems like an interesting solution to the problem, because if the cables aren't there, and I'm an internet provider, I'm thinking, well, are there enough people in this community who are willing to pay enough to, you know, justify me putting these things in the ground? Well, that part's already done now, right? So if I'm one of these companies or five of these companies, that's already there and I'm just doing the thing I mainly do.
Exactly. So because the infrastructure now exists, because the city of Superior has made that investment in our community, these providers can come on, focus on what they do best. So we're not asking them all to make these huge infrastructure investments, right? They can focus on what they do best. We get more diversity of offerings for our citizens, and we keep moving forward.
I want to get a little before and after here, Stephanie. Before this started, what were the kind of experiences people were having? What kind of problems were they running into because the community didn't have this kind of high-speed access?
That is such a good question, and I can think of just a few experiences, right? Some places in Superior have great access, right? They are right by the lake. They're right next to a tower. So some people in Superior are like, what are you talking about? Everything's fine. And then there's everybody else that just saw things spinning. And really, when COVID hit and we were asking school children to just do everything online, when we were asking everybody to, you can do it online, it'll work, it didn't. So things spun and they spun and they spun, and services went down for, you know, maintenance windows that weren't scheduled. Oh, sorry, you just have to deal with it. So that level of just waiting and then being told, well, you can do this while you miss an appointment, while you miss a class, while you just can't. So that was the experience. And on this other end of it, now I think my favorite story is working with a college professor who works in communication. And he showed me his setup with his kid. They have these awesome gaming setups that he and his 10-year-old play together. Now they can play at the exact same time while he's uploading photos for class, while he's sending videos to his counterpart in Madison. So he's able to work, he's able to play, he's able to do all at the same time. And he's like, this is what we're supposed to be able to do. When people say this is what technology is, he's like, this is what technology is supposed to do. And now Superior has it.
Right, that's an example. What has the uptake been since you flipped the switch? I'm guessing there wasn't an actual switch, but metaphorically flipped the switch. What has the reaction been in town?
Very positive. I would say there's always people who are waiting for it, right? Who is like, well, when is it my turn? And that is the hardest question to answer, right? And it's hard to say, well, this neighbor has it now. We're at about 10% of our area that can have it, now have it. So we passed over just over 800 houses. We are well over 80 orders. So within the first 2 months, we've hit 10% of our potential customer base, which is huge. That was a number for an entire year, and we've done that in 2 months, and it just keeps growing. So a lot of the initial ones were looking at their neighbors that got it first, like, okay, what's it really like? And what's it really like? It's great. So the next pieces are like the longevity of it, to continue to make sure that the service is high quality, to continue to help people be curious, right? To learn why it's different, why it might fit their lives really, really well. And just to continue to support people as they learn.
Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, you bet.
We're talking about a new city-owned broadband network. That was Stephanie Becken, broadband manager for the city of Superior. Now, other communities around the state are facing similar issues that Superior has: slow internet speeds, lack of reliable access, and companies not showing up to build those things. Christopher Mitchell is director of community broadband networks at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Chris, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
This issue of broadband access, how big a deal is it? How common is it for people to not have these kind of speeds in communities that you need in a lot of ways to participate in modern life?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a majority of people, but it's more than a few. And we don't really know how many because no government agency is tracking this effectively. We know that there are millions of people with no internet service. And I would say that most people probably have a decent service. And I would say more than 50%. But somewhere in between are the people who are dissatisfied, and legitimately so.
The Trump administration canceled the Digital Equity Act earlier this year. What kind of impact has that had on state and local efforts to expand broadband access?
So it is helpful to know that the Digital Equity Act is kind of the more the skills, the devices, and trying to develop plans for affordability. And that has been turned off. There is still money going to rural areas where people don't have a wire or a strong wireless signal. And there are also changes happening there under the Trump administration. But those are two separate things, and they're kind of both going in the wrong direction. We thought we were going to be much further ahead in 2026, 2027 than I think we will be now, unfortunately.
Focusing on infrastructure and efforts by local communities to develop their own, places like Superior. I'm looking at your website right now. There's a sentence: the legal environment in Wisconsin is generally unfavorable toward municipal broadband utilities. What are some of the obstacles you see in place in Wisconsin?
Wisconsin has some state laws that make it a little more challenging for communities to embrace some business models. I don't know if Superior would say that they have been disadvantaged, but if you're a city that would like to build a network where the city itself is offering service, there might be additional hurdles that were put there, I think historically, by the lobbyists from companies like AT&T, Charter Spectrum, and others who were concerned about competition, and they tried to limit any competition that they would face.
If a community, if say a local community leader's out there listening, saying, yeah, we don't have great broadband service and we don't have, you know, companies knocking on our doors wanting to build it, what do you suggest as a first step toward doing some kind of municipal-backed internet service?
I think the first thing to do is to research. And I say that very seriously because this is something that we've seen hundreds of cities do. I think there's on the order of 800 cities that have had some kind of intervention, with about 300 cities having a citywide service. And we've seen some cities struggle because it is hard. Cities can do it, and the overwhelming number of cities have done it well. But the cities that have done it well have taken it seriously. They've spent time understanding it. They've worked with consultants or others who have industry experience to understand where things could go wrong and to have a plan for that. And then the other thing I think that's really important is that some cities have a track record of just making good infrastructure investments. And that often comes from a healthy council that is doing the research and taking local input seriously, making sure that they have a sense of what the demand is from residents and from businesses. That's all important before one goes too far down this road.
You were recently, I understand, Chris, part of leading a tribal broadband boot camp in the UP in Michigan that included some Wisconsin tribes. What were some of your takeaways from that?
Yes, we are seeing a lot of tribal nations starting to build their own networks. Within Wisconsin, you actually have Bad River, Lac du Flambeau, Red Cliff are just three of the tribes that have made investments, sometimes with federal support. And they are trying to make sure that people on the reservation are well served. And then of the about 100 of the networks we see around the country that are tribal internet service providers, many of them have actually started serving the rural areas around them somewhat because they're already building a network for people on the reservation. It makes sense to go beyond that a little bit so they can help the communities around them. You know, there's parts of Wisconsin where you can have amazing internet service from a local company or some company that's made the investment. And then you could go 10 miles down the road and find that people have really poor service. Well, that 10 miles down the road is where we often see the tribal nations, where there has not been a lot of investment. And that's why many of them are starting to build their own networks to make sure that they can decide how to engage with the technology of today and tomorrow.
Chris, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Christopher Mitchell, Director of Community Broadband Networks at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. We also heard from Stephanie Becken, Broadband Manager for the City of Superior. We've been talking about efforts around the state to bring high-speed internet to rural communities, including Superior's new city-owned fiber optic network called Connect Superior. How is internet service in your community? Did it get better over the last few years, or are there still a lot of problems? Let us know about it. You can send us an email, wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, Wisconsin author Jane Hamilton shares her newest novel out this week, The Phoebe Variations.
Where did I have to go and be to write this book? In Wisconsin, of course.
That conversation is next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In her novels, Wisconsin author Jane Hamilton shares the Midwest with the world. Her breakthrough, The Book of Ruth, and her follow-up, Map of the World, both made Oprah's book list and were adapted as screenplays.
She has a new book out this week, written in her farmhouse on a Wisconsin apple orchard. The Phoebe Variations follows a teenage girl through a rocky transition to adulthood in Illinois and Wisconsin.
Jane Hamilton is with us now for a look at The Phoebe Variations and her writing career here in Wisconsin. Jane, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I would like you to start, if you would, by introducing us to Phoebe and maybe Phoebe's plural, because we have, you know, Phoebe in her teen graduating high school years, but also Phoebe looking back decades later on the events in the book.
Yes, that's true. Phoebe is, when the book opens, is almost 18. She has recently had a shattering experience encountering her birth family. She's been adopted. She lives in a suburb not unlike Oak Park, Illinois, where I happen to have grown up in the 1970s. And this encounter with her birth family propels her to run away from her mother and to hide in the basement of a household that has 14 children, as many households did in those days in Oak Park, Illinois in the 70s. And, well, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 children. And Phoebe is looking back at an episode right before her high school graduation and afterwards, which ended up defining her life.
Another thing that strikes me is the moms in the book.
Yes.
Phoebe's birth mom, her adoptive mom, the mom of that 14-family household, and eventually, I hope you don't mind a spoiler, eventually Phoebe herself. And the questions about, you know, as a parent, what we get wrong as a kid, how we evaluate how our parents did, whether we forgive what they did. There's so many different angles on that. Run with that wherever you want to go, Jane.
Well, I was really interested in the mothers of that time because, as I said, so many of them had so many children, and yet it was the 70s, so probably some of them had read the feminist mystique. Probably some of them wondered, wait, why did I have 11 children? Probably some of them had decided to take matters into their own hands and take the birth control pill. Some of them did go back to work. So I think that although those tensions still exist now, and there's this, you know, the trad wife movement and all of that, I think that that there probably was a lot of tension in the psyches of those mothers of the 1970s. And I was interested in exploring that. And I realized the other day that I'm also exploring the fathers of that time, because there is a secret drinking society in this town that is not unlike Oak Park, Illinois. And it's where the fathers, the men, can escape without having any women around. So there's that too. But I just, you know, I still think, how did those mothers wake up every morning and think, okay, 12 people to feed for breakfast, gotta make the lunches, where are the permission slips, did everybody do their spelling homework? I mean, how did, you know, really, how did they cope?
I want to bring Wisconsin into this. That's what we focus on a lot here on the show. And Wisconsin, Phoebe, her birth family is in the Driftless area. Her best friend, there's a promised getaway at a summer place in Wisconsin. There is eventually an escape to a family's farmland in Wisconsin. Talk a little bit about Wisconsin, please, as a setting.
Why wouldn't you set your novel in Wisconsin? I'm going to be talking later today with Liam Callahan, who wrote When in Rome and a book about Paris. So he has always had to go to Rome and Paris. Where did I have to go and be to write this book? In Wisconsin, of course. Luna has a summer place in Lake Geneva, which is called Lilac Hill. And I don't know if you have ever walked around Lake Geneva. I have. It's 22 miles and a little bit more if you get lost in the golf course. But those houses, many of them are just remarkable, and long lawns down to the lakefront and lilacs and peonies. Anyway, I loved Luna having that very beautiful, special place that is dear to Phoebe's heart too. And then the family of 14 children has a farmhouse in near Viroqua, and there actually is a town in Wisconsin called Romance, which I mention in the novel, and I love that. And the farm is beautiful and run down, and the house is a shack with drywall falling apart and carpet squares. Wisconsin is a rich state for narrative possibilities, for sure.
We're talking to Wisconsin author Jane Hamilton about her writing career and her new novel, The Phoebe Variations. Jane, fans of yours have been waiting, I think, eagerly for a novel. It's been a spell since the last one. And you've talked elsewhere about there was some push and pull with publishers over this. People might think, hey, map of the world author, they're going to take what she gives them and likes it. What went on during the process of writing this book, working with publishers, and then ultimately going with an independent publisher?
Well, I'm very grateful for my publishers through the years who have saved me from myself. And I was writing iteration after iteration of this book. And my agent then of the at the time kept saying, nope. And as painful as that failure was, I just kept thinking, if I can't make a book work that's about a girl who runs away and hides out in a basement of 14 children, 12 of whom are boys, and she has three significant experiences with three different, she's in the land of men, then really I need to find another career path because that's just got so many possibilities. But I couldn't see through to the end, really. And I kept taking her to New York City and other places. And really, she just had to be in Wisconsin. That was the answer. She had to click her ruby slippers and end up in Wisconsin. And so I had to, you know, keep the focus tight. And it took me a long time for the friendship of Luna to come into focus. So the publishers kept saying, no. And then my agent, who, again, I'm very grateful to her at the time, she said, Jane, I cannot read this book one more time. And, you know, that's fair. She'd read it probably 10 times. But in answer to your question, really, just because I wrote a book that sold a lot of copies doesn't mean that they'll publish just anything you hand in. And it's very painful to me to look at the stacks of boxes in my study that are the printed out copies of those failures, because, you know, I can't really look at them, but I think there's some good writing in there. And also some of the plots were very amusing to write, and I enjoyed them. And I always enjoyed being with Phoebe. She was always a pleasure to be with. So it just sometimes takes a long time for the thing to take its proper shape.
You use the word failures at least twice there. Are you being a little hard on yourself? Were they just, you know, steps along the path? Maybe Luna would say, hey, these are steps along the path to the true outcome, or something like that, your character.
Okay, well, you could call it what you want, but they were novels that did not work.
Finally, you're known, Jane, in part for living at and writing from your Wisconsin orchard. What is it about your home that makes it a special setting for you to create in?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't have to commute to work. I look out to the orchard where people are toiling, and sometimes I toil there too. And I'm just so grateful to have a connection to the natural world that's easily accessible. And I can eat a really good apple every single day of my life.
Jane, thanks so much for sharing your new book with us.
Thank you for having me again. It's been a pleasure.
Jane Hamilton is a critically acclaimed author of a lot of best-selling books who lives and writes in an orchard farmhouse in Wisconsin. She was with us to share the story of her newest novel. It's The Phoebe Variations.
And now let's turn to our fall membership drive for an update. Keely Baltina joins me here in the studio, and we're here to say that it's listeners, and that means you, who provide the largest source of funding here at WPR. And this drive is your chance to support all the programs you enjoy. So give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Listeners have long been the largest source of funding for WPR. Until this summer, federal funding was also a big piece of that budget pie for the programs that we offer. Not as big a piece as listeners, but still really important. Congress cut federal funding over the summer, and that means that your support is what will preserve public media here in Wisconsin. We can keep WPR strong together, and part of that is you making your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
One thing that I love, 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 love about WPR is that we get to celebrate Wisconsin authors like novelist Jane Hamilton. What an interview. I mean, learning about her new novel set in Wisconsin and You know, she tells Rob Wisconsin is this rich state for narrative possibilities. The interview's a treasure, and it's made possible because of your support. WPR is listener-supported. It means that when you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, you make this hour of Wisconsin Today and so many more hours and conversations possible. So choose an amount that works for you. Take that few minutes and make your gift.
Kate, when I see any like WPR merch out in the wild, I do have to admit that I compliment it. I do. Yeah. And I love getting a compliment for whatever I'm wearing that's related to WPR.
Yep.
If you are one of those people like me, you can show off your WPR pride this time around with our latest thank you gift, which is a WPR canvas backpack. If you liked the t-shirt design with all of the Wisconsin symbols and those beautiful muted colors and the big Wisconsin Public Radio, you are going to want this in backpack form too. The backpack is made in the U.S. It has two straps with a drawstring closure. So if you're like, I got enough tote bags. No, you don't. This is different and exciting. It's got that colorful WPR theme design. So ask for yours when you give $22 a month so that you can spread the word about your support of WPR. Give at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
And think about the value that everything you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio is the result of thoughtful preparation. We do our homework so that you get the highest quality programs. So show your commitment to this quality. Commit now when you make your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I would say that if you really enjoy public radio and you listen to it even occasionally, if it does something to enlighten you on a certain point of view, then that is value. It's valuable. But nothing in life that is of value is truly free. Being a sustaining member, even if you just donate a small amount each month, you know, what it would cost you for a cup of coffee is really, really worth it if you believe in what they're doing. And I do. I'm John from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I encourage you to join me in sustaining Wisconsin Public Radio.
Go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 to make your donation this fall member drive. I'm Kate Archer-Kent here with Keely Boltina. Join in with your gift now because WPR's essential service is available to you and your community and your neighbors, thanks to your support.
Chances are WPR has covered an issue that is close to you. Chances are also that you've heard something on WPR that gives you maybe a different perspective, somebody who lives a different life than you do, or that you've made assumptions about how other people experience things, and something you've heard here has challenged that and expanded your understanding of your community and the people who live in the same place. I mean, you can count on WPR for shows that are relevant, that are interesting, that are enjoyable, that really make a difference to you here in Wisconsin. Because WPR touches your life, make a gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And just think of the value because, you know, sometimes you do actually get more than you pay for. WPR is that place where that is true. Consider a gift of $2 a day to support the radio programs that you love.
At WPR, $2 a day makes a lot of the news and information and conversation that you hear possible. That works out to about $60 a month. Take that next step. Make that gift now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And however you choose to give, thank you so much. Your support is powerful, and there's still something more you can do to help. You can encourage a family member, a friend, to join the Wisconsin Public Radio community.
Spread the love. Tell your friends and family that you support WPR. Wear your WPR t-shirt or your hat, or use that water bottle that's got the sticker on it from a previous drive. Inspire others to make a gift too. And start with yours at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And, you know, a successful member drive works when everyone chips in. We all do a little bit of our part. So please do that now. Take a moment and make your gift at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. 2552, and your support of WPR means so much to keeping all of your favorite programs on the air.
And now is a good time, too, whether this is your first donation or you do already donate, become a sustainer. That offers WPR a really reliable source of funding. You still control how much you give. You can increase it if you have to decrease it. That control lies with you, but you also know that your support is always current. So set up those ongoing monthly donations from a bank account or a credit card to provide that support to WPR. You do that and become a sustainer at WPR.org or by calling 888-202-2552. Thank you so much for your support. We really appreciate it.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Rochelle Wilson, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.